didn't think I was going to get here this morning, but it's good because everyone was late, as well as me. The second lecture that I'm giving is on Shklovsky's essay artist technique. And what I'm going to do is talk a bit about the concept of art and what Shklovsky's specifically doing to contribute to that debate. And then I'll go on to talk about his main concepts in that essay. And the key word that you've got to remember with Shklovsky is this word defamiliarization. Defamiliarization, for those of you who've already read it, you'll know that's his key word. And I'll go on to talk about how Shklovsky thinks that language has a revolutionary and political aspect to it, but not in the same way as perhaps some of the other critics that you've looked at, some of the Marxists, feminists, post-colonialists, etc., who see literature as a means for achieving a kind of material politics. That's not what Shklovsky's doing. Shklovsky says that that politics, it's interesting, is materialized in language itself. So that's the difference, I think, between some of the critics that you've been looking at through the term, that critics like Terry Eagleton, for example, French feminists like Helene Cixous, Luce Irigaray, those kind of critics think that language produces political action, whereas Shklovsky is saying that political action is language. And there we go. Right then, so one of the first questions that I want to address is, how do we even know what an art object is? And that's a key question for Shklovsky in using this word art. I mean, obviously it's a translation from the Russian, but he is using the word art in a very kind of particular way. And what he wants to do is think about what are the intrinsic or inherent qualities to a piece of art that makes it a piece of art. And we can look at that in a couple of different ways. This is going to be interesting, isn't it? For the sake of the tape, a little box keeps popping up on my PowerPoint. So let's think about the two different ways in which we can look at art. Now, the critic John Dewey, D-E-W-E-Y, John Dewey, very important philosopher at the beginning of the 20th century, he says that if an author says, or an artist says, that the thing that he's produced or she's produced is a piece of art, then it is a piece of art. That's what Dewey says. So he goes completely down the author's line. So I could just sort of say, hey, I've just created this amazing sculpture with these pens. There we are, there's my piece of art. And because I say it's a piece of art, it is a piece of art. That's Dewey's argument in a very crude, summarized way. Other critics, such as Leo Tolstoy, also writing sort of similar time to Dewey, claims that what makes a text or an object a piece of art is the way in which the reader experiences it. So it's the reader's, it's on the reader to make it into a piece of art. So if I say, here's my amazing pen sculpture, and you say, no, I don't experience that as a piece of art, it's rubbish, then it's not a piece of art anymore. Now, those questions, I think, can be particularly addressed by a piece of art that was very famous and is still quite famous, which is Andy Warhol's Brillo pads. And you'll have to look at them through this little box that keeps popping up. But, I mean, everyone knows Warhol's Brillo boxes. They were made in 1964. They're exact replicas of the original Brillo pad boxes that were sold in the 1960s. Do you still have Brillo pads? Brillo pads still on, yeah? Yay! It's because I've got a Mac. I don't understand these things. Thank you. So, the Brillo pad, we've just deciphered that we do still sell them. Now, even though you probably don't use them. These Brillo pad boxes that Warhol made are made up of hollow plywood boxes. They're made of wood, and then they're silk screen printed onto with the label. Now, if I just click here, there's Warhol looking a little bit out of it. It's a little bit how I feel. And there's somebody looking at a Brillo pad box in a nice glass container there to show that it's a piece of art. That immediately makes it look like a piece of art. And here is the real Brillo box. There's no difference. There's no difference between them at all. And in fact, no one remembers who created that Brillo box. It was a marketing executive called James Harvey. It's his design. He created it. But everyone remembers Warhol because that, what you're looking at there, is just a package with Brillo pads in it. Whereas what Warhol does is silk screen the image onto wood, which makes it look like a piece of art. So in other words, I suppose what Warhol is trying to say is that his insight really is how we judge and define art. He's saying that because we look at his object in an artistic way, and that we see it as a medium of art, it becomes a medium of art. So really for him, for Warhol, he's siding with the Tolstoy argument. It's the form of that art that makes it a piece of art, and it's our response to it that makes it a piece of art. But I think what I want to emphasize here is that it's the form that is particularly important. It's the fact that he transformed a cardboard box into something that was made of recognizably art-based objects, wood, silkscreen, ink, etc. Now, that idea of form dominating the text or the art object to allow us to understand what it is an idea called formalism, surprisingly, which you may have already come across this year. But Shklovsky is a leading formalist, and so I want to talk quite a lot now about that movement of formalism and what that means. In a very basic sense, formalism is simply a term that we give to literary critics who focus on the style and devices of a text, paying very close attention to the words used instead of how they reflect the world outside. So instead of looking at a poem as if it's some sort of sponge that you can squeeze the meaning out, and then here it is, here's the meaning. Ooh, let's read the prelude by Wordsworth or it's about the French Revolution. Formalist critics don't want to do that. They don't want the text to kind of make them think of other things outside of the text. They want you to look at the individual words and the style and the rhythm and to just sort of almost forget about the external in order to focus very specifically on the words themselves. Now, Shklovsky was a formalist. There he is. I always think it's nice to look at these people. I think he gives you a little insight into their lives. When we come to look at Barthes and Foucault next week, we'll see that they're much more handsome. Barthes particularly is very handsome. And that's a good thing. So here's Russian Shklovsky looking sort of formidable. And I mean, he really is sort of at the forefront of what we call Russian formalism. And all we mean by that is a group of Russian critics that were arguing that formalism was the best way to interpret art. Now, they're important to us as literary critics because they lay the foundations for what a lot of modern literary criticism or a lot of modern literary formalism will do because of the way in which they pay attention specifically to poetic language. And they also want to ask this question of how do you tell that a piece of art is a piece of art? But they specifically want to ask, how do we tell that a literary text is a literary text? What is there about the word literary that has a meaning to it that we can explain without kind of having to refer to the outside world? What is it that distinguishes a literary text from other kinds of texts in the world? What is it about a poem that makes it not a shopping list, that makes it not a diary or not a recipe book? Now, a lot of modern... And by modern criticism, I mean criticism sort of written from the 1980s onwards. The most dominant mode of criticism that we are dealing with as literary critics kind of now from the 1980s onwards is historicism. And historicism is desperate to tell you that everything is a text. Here again, here's another text, The Amazing Pen Sculpture. That's a text. Recipe books are text. A shopping list is a text. Any bit of rubbish that you can find in an archive in the olden days is a text. But the formalists say that's nonsense. There is something about a poem that makes it more interesting than just another historical scrap from the past. There is something, more interesting about a poem than what they find on cash in the attic. there's a sort of sense in which they're trying to distinguish themselves from historicism, even at the beginning of the 20th century. They say that once we know what distinguishes literature from everything else in the world, we can then focus on those aspects and make them the kind of formal base point of literary theory. And so they're committed to defining what poetic language is. And this is the group that Shklovsky is associated with, and the group that particularly are interested in trying to work out what poetic language is. That I'm just noticing now that PowerPoint looks a little bit like when you go to the optician with all those different letters on, but there's the Russian at the bottom, for those of you who want to write down Russian and speak Russian. Now, this group that Shklovsky's part of argue that literary texts are like little machines. That's the kind of metaphor that they use. But these little machines, they say, are created through human skill, and they can be dissembled into their individual parts to be understood and explored. So they're interested in the way in which a poem is like a kind of, almost like a very delicate little clock, and you can sort of break it open and see all of the intricate parts inside that clock and start to kind of work out how they fit together and put it back again to make the kind of machine whole again. And that's literary reading, that's literary interpretation. Shklovsky understands that poems are organic, so that kind of idea of the machine isn't totally one that they want to divorce from something that's living. They're not totally talking about literature as if it's machinic. There is something that lives, but there's a sort of basicness, there's a basic functionality of texts that you can recognize. The most obvious example is a sonnet. We know what a sonnet is. It's 14 lines. There's basic things in literature that you can recognize to say, this is what makes it so. And that's particularly why they're interested in poetry, because poetry is perhaps the easiest to do that with. You'll, I'm sure, explore in your degree and with your tutors the way in which poetry can deeply subvert its own conventions all the time. I'm not suggesting that poetry is always fixed, but there are recognizable ways of understanding what certain kinds of poetry are. It's easy to see what an elegy is. It's about a dead person. It's easy to see what a sonnet is. It's got 14 lines. It's easy to see what an epic is. It's really, really long. You know, there's a sense in which we can recognize what poems are. So the shared ideas that Opajaz have is that texts are recognizable through their constituent parts. And they want to think about poetry both in, as I say, in this machine-like way, but also like a jigsaw puzzle, something that you can kind of put together. But poetry, I think, is also very significant to them because of the way poems communicate their constituent parts, not just through their appearance on the page, but through their sound. And that's very important to them too, the sound. Their rhyme, onomatopoeia, alliteration, assonance, sound repetitions, all of those are little constituent parts in the kind of the jigsaw puzzle as well. They're not material, but we can hear them. Another formalist who's associated with this group, very famous formalist called Roman Jakobson, or Jakobson, depending on how you want to pronounce it, which is J-A-K-O-B-S-O-N, Jakobson. He called poetry organized violence committed on ordinary speech. Organized violence committed on ordinary speech. As if somehow what you're doing with words is kind of cutting them up and violently reordering them into the shape of a poem. Shklovsky and Jakobson suggest that poetry forces the reader to think about ordinary events in unusual ways. And that's important to them because it means that it stops us having a habitual or familiar response to the world around us. Speech is the way in which we just talk between ourselves, between our friends, in our families, is often very familiarized. Often small groups of friends or families will have specific words that mean specific things only to that family. Jakobson and Shklovsky like the poem because it sort of breaks us out of any kind of familiarity. It stops us from being complacent about words that we think we understand and commits this act of violence onto them. Now that sense of committing that act of violence, Shklovsky calls defamiliarization. And so just let me go on to talk about defamiliarization now. He argues that readers should approach the work of art independently from the social, the historical, and the biographical. And I think the way in which, one of the things that he's most hostile towards is biography. And we'll come on to talk a bit more about that next week with the theory of the death of the author. But the way in which certain texts can be read for the biography of the author, Shklovsky finds deeply politically complacent and problematic. It makes the text feel very familiar to us and cozy in a way that he feels uncomfortable with. Jane Eyre is Charlotte Bronte. David Copperfield is Dickens. It's easy to do it with 19th century novels, often because those novels are semi-autobiographical. And Victorian literary critics are very interested in biography. That's the only way they tend to read books in the 19th century. So Shklovsky, coming at the beginning of the 20th century, is rejecting that old way of reading, that biographical way of reading. So instead of reading by looking outside of the text for explanations, Shklovsky argues that we need to read texts through what he calls defamiliarization. He says that we all read automatically, making sense of language by comparing it to ideas and meanings that are already familiar to us. Now, this has the effect, he says, of deadening us to the text because we simply read it for what we know. We're just looking for what we already find familiar in it. And that's the problem for him with historical and biographical readings. You might not even have had to have read the text, as many of you, I'm sure, will know. It's much quicker to go and look at Wikipedia than it is to actually sit down and read the poem, work out what your own ideas are. He doesn't want you to do that. He doesn't want that kind of external knowledge coming in and giving you access, making the poem like this little code that you can crack and then you know what the meaning is and then you can just sort of stop reading it and that's the end of that. He says that if art and literature can defamiliarize our natural way of reading the world, it then opens us up to different horizons of thinking, new ways of thinking, new perceptual modes of experience. And that's significant for Shklovsky, who's writing in a kind of period which is intensely filled with war, with economic crisis. I suppose we could compare it to today. But for Shklovsky, as for a lot of kind of Russian Marxists who he's quite close to, there's a sense that history keeps repeating itself. It's a cliche, but it does. So how do you get out of that? How do you stop history from repeating itself? Well, you teach people to think in different ways and stop them from thinking in exactly the same way as they've been thinking, for the whole of history. The moment we can admit that we don't know what we think about a text or what we feel about a text is the moment that's politically radical for Shklovsky, because that's the moment in which you can start to reassess the world around you and reflect on why you feel confused and displaced. So what's interesting to him is not being in a seminar and saying, I don't know what this means. It's being in a seminar and saying, I don't know what this means, and then reflecting on that not knowingness. Why don't you know what it means? What is it about the words that feel uncomfortable to you? What is it about the text that you're reading that stops you from understanding it? What is it about a Shakespearean monologue that where the words seem to somehow alienate you unless they're performed? Why? He wants you to kind of ask all of those questions. If we only read texts through what we're used to, through kind of familiar ways of reading, our perception of and way of interpreting becomes what he calls habitual. It's a very important word, habitual. It just means, as you know, habit forming. So that we automatically produce meanings in our heads without even knowing it. And that's what ideology is, right? It's the fact that we automatically assume that our ideas are so original and so interesting, but in fact they're just merely a reflection of what everybody else is doing all along. I mean, a great example of this would be the figure of Holden Caulfield in, you know, Catcher in the Rye, he thinks he's so original, he thinks he's so isolated. And he, the great sort of horror for Holden is that every other person that he meets thinks in exactly the same way. Everyone thinks everyone else is a phony. But so that kind of sense of just simply repeating the experience of the world by kind of constantly placing yourself outside of it, even that is habitual if everybody is doing it. And for Shklovsky particularly, the problem with reading in a habitual way is that it reduces language to algebra. It might as well be maths, he says, because if all you're going to do is just add up all the numbers and work out what the meaning is, it just equates to a signification, which makes it very formulaic. And here's his quote from As Technique. And so life is reckoned as nothing. Habitualization devours works, clothes, furniture, one's wife, and the fear of war. If the whole complex lives of many people go on unconsciously, then such lives are as if they had never been. What's the point if you're not going to think in a different way, or at least try, because you're just conforming in a way that you're already erasing yourself from history. To stop us from falling into this kind of paralysis of habit and routine, Shklovsky argues that poetry has this power to jolt us out of that defamiliarization, jolt us into defamiliarization and out of habitual readings. And this is what he says about art. An art exists that one may recover the sensation of life. It exists to make one feel things, to make the stone stony. The purpose of art is to import the sensation of things as they are perceived and not as they are known. So it's that sense of kind of reading literature as if you can somehow forget everything that you've already learned, so that you're reading it in this fresh way. He goes on to say, the technique of art is to make objects unfamiliar, to make forms difficult, to increase the difficulty and length of perception, because the process of perception is an aesthetic end in itself and must be prolonged. Art is a way of experiencing the artfulness of an object. The object is not important. The object is not important. The thing that's being described in the poem is not important for the Russian formalists. It's the way in which it's being described and the way in which the poetry shifts our perception of it. So what does that mean? It means the experience of the text is more important than the text itself. Art exists to make one feel things. Art stops us from making assumptions, and it stops us from having automatic reactions to things, and forces us to have a feeling. And I think Shklovsky would even kind of go on to say, forces us to have a sort of authentic feeling, an authentic feeling, not one that's created by ideology. And it's easy to have an ideological feeling, right? I mean, you can all be sort of sitting in a cinema. I remember when I went to see Dirty Dancing when I was young, that shows how massively old I am. And you know, you've seen Dirty Dancing, right? Yeah, of course, you know Dirty Dancing. And then when Patrick Swayze does the lift at the end, he lifts the girl into the air. They've never been able to do that before. And everyone in the cinema stood up and started clapping. And I was like, yeah, he's lifted her up. And I had this feeling of like, hooray, Patrick Swayze has had a romantic interaction with the heroine. Fabulous. But I mean, that wasn't an authentic feeling. Afterwards, I was like, well, you know, what do I really care about, you know, Patrick Swayze lifting up this girl? It's you're in a crowd and you have that sense of being carried away by a feeling. For Shklovsky, that's not a real feeling. That's not really coming from you. Now, some critics will argue, many of them, Marxist critics, feminist critics, post-colonialists again, that there isn't any such thing as an authentic response. There's no authentic response. Anyway, because it's always going to be filtered through ideology, so you're never going to be able to have that authentic response. And you have to make up your own minds about what you think of that question. I think you can. That when I do my research, I think you can have an authentic feeling, but that's partly because my own research is on romantic poetry, and romantic poetry is based on the idea that you can have an authentic feeling, which is not filtered through ideology. The feeling is the thing that can get you outside and allows for this process of defamiliarization to happen. some critics would totally disagree and say that's naive, that you can't get outside of ideology. But for our purposes here, Shklovsky thinks that you can. And he particularly thinks that poetry, again, is important because it's already a bit strange and defamiliarizing. Poetry is already difficult. So it's a good way of describing the world because of the way in which the rhythms and the meters of poetry block us from finding a quick and familiar reading and force us to think about different ways of understanding. Shklovsky, elsewhere in the essay, calls the language of poetry a difficult, roughened, impeded language. Really nice words, a difficult, roughened, impeded language. Impeding, obstructing normative and predictable interpretations. Reading poetry for him is just like the tense and watchful feelings we experience when someone comes towards us looking like they might physically attack us. As the philosopher Herbert Spencer points out, and this is Shklovsky quotes Spencer here, just as the body, in receiving a series of varying concussions, must keep the muscles ready to meet the most violent of them, as not knowing when such may come, so the mind in reading poetry, and so receiving unarranged articulations, poems, must keep its perspectives active enough to recognize the least easily caught sounds. What do you feel like when somebody comes towards you, you know, with a knife or with a gun? I hope you don't know what that feeling is, but that's what Shklovsky is saying you should feel like when you're reading a poem. You should have this sense of being confronted by something and being unsettled by it. Now, I just want to say a few more words about ideology and about this kind of question of the relationship between the text and the external world. Even though Shklovsky argues that we should not bring in external material when we're reading the text, he does recognize that as readers, we are all in different positions, and that as readers, we have very different experiences of the text. So he doesn't expect us as readers to all sit there like kind of robots cleansed of all of our being. It's just that he doesn't want you to seek outside of the text for external information. And he's particularly interested, as all Marxists are, in our class position and how our class position mediates how we read. He follows, as you know, Karl Marx's idea that the way in which we act and think is determined by ideology. There's no implication in ideology. You know what ideology means. We talked about it a little bit last week. It's this term that Marxist critics use to talk about how cultures are structured in ways that enable the group holding power to have the maximum amount of impact in the ideas that are most dominant. There's no implication for Shklovsky that there's powerful people that are deliberately kind of going around oppressing like non-powerful people. That's not what ideology is. Ideology is much more slippery than that. It's the sense that the powerful somehow infiltrate institutions and spread the most dominant ideas. And the powerful almost don't even know that they're doing it. It's not like they're kind of baddies or villains. They're unable to control spreading those ideas through institutions like the government, education, the church, the family, and so on. And even, I suppose, for a kind of very radical Marxist, they would say even the university does that, because all we do is kind of stand here every single year saying, hey, you know, why don't you read things in a really radical way? And so that kind of allows you to have 3 years when you can like read radically and feel like you're right on, and then you can go and get a job in whatever those places in the city are, and you know you've had your time being a Marxist, so you know you've kind of let out your kind of radical edge. So even universities are somehow, I think, for extreme Marxists, complicit in that process of stopping you from reading the text in a defamiliarized way. They're invested in you reading the world and texts in a habitual way. So what does Shklovsky say? He says we can have a revolution through language. We have a revolution through language. And that idea is extremely important to Russian formalists and to post-structuralists too. He says the act of interpreting a text helps us to think where ideology comes from and analyse how it's sustained. How is it that the same ideas keep getting repeated over and over again? Poetry is the most radical, again, he says, because of the way in which it's implicitly ambiguous and so forces us to think in lots of different ways at once, which is automatically an antidote to ideology. Because ideology is asking you to think in one way, right? Whereas a poem, because it looks so weird, I mean, particularly Howl, where you're reading these words that have so many different meanings and they're kind of wandering all over the place, the sentence structures don't seem to be making any sense, you're automatically having lots of different ideas at once. You can't hold in your head a narrative. I mean, unless you're a very particular kind of reader, it'd be quite difficult to read Howl just as a story and then be able to summarise what it was about after you'd read it. It's forcing you for your mind to kind of keep going off in different places and think lots of things at the same time. So to return to Ginsberg and to part two of the poem, which I said I'd look at this week, we can immediately see that Ginsberg is using his text to play around with poetic form. And again, if we think about what Shklovsky was saying at the beginning, he likes the way in which poetry is recognisably art because it conforms to certain patterns. So Howl is recognisably a poem. It's not that wacky and radical that you can't see that it's a poem. And in fact, if you read it in a really literary, formal way and scan it, you can see that it is written in a triadic form. It does force the breath into these kind of triadic breath-length sentences. But it's too hard to kind of sustain where all of the beats come. So it's a perfect kind of Shklovskian poem. It's both formal, it's obviously a poem, but it undermines that at the same time by creating this kind of revolution in language by undermining its own formal ability. Ginsberg deliberately stops us from being able to scan the poem, go through it and kind of put the beats over the top of it, by writing in this very disorientating and hallucinatory way. And he does so partly by drawing on these traditional forms. I just want to talk quickly about one traditional form that he uses in the poem, which is anaphora. Anaphora. A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A. Anaphora. A-N-A-P-H-O-R-A. That means that the repetition of a word or a phrase at the beginning of successive clauses. The most famous example of anaphoric speech, which you always get in textbooks, is Winston Churchill's speech in World War II when he uses the anaphora, "We shall fight. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender." That we shall, it kind of whips you up into this sort of frenzy of feeling really moved along with the poem. All politicians use it as a way to kind of structure their speech and bring you back to what they're trying to say to you and pull you in. So you can hear just from that anaphora pushes this text on and makes possible also a very long line. If I just read Winston Churchill's speech in a kind of very sort of straightforward way, "We shall fight on the beaches, then we'll fight on the landing grounds, and then I guess we might go into the fields and streets." It doesn't have that same ability to carry you through, "We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds." That sense of a really long breath in a poem, Ginsberg calls bardic breath. That's Ginsberg's description of it, the bardic breath. He says, "My breath is long. That's the measure, one physical mental inspiration of thought contained in the elastic of breath. My breath is long." That idea of drawing in the breath is also related back to the idea of typewriter jazz that I talked a bit about last week, in that the breath is often very important if you're playing jazz instruments like trumpets or saxophones. It has that kind of saxophonic feeling of being drawn in, but it also keeps the beat. And I guess that Ginsberg uses several anaphoric phrases throughout the poem. It's the word who in part one. He keeps sort of using the word who all the way through. The anaphoric phrase in part two is Moloch. And I'll talk about Moloch in a minute. Where he simply just repeats that phrase, Moloch, Moloch, nightmare of Moloch, Moloch the loveless, mental Moloch, Moloch the heavy judge of men. You know, that you get that sort of same Winston Churchill-y feeling. And then the anaphora in part three, obviously, is I'm with you in Rockland, and I'll come back to that next week. But they're all refrains that kind of structure the poem, even though you're kind of having this dizzying effect. Again, speaking to that Shklovskian idea that we can recognize that it's a poem, but it's also defamiliarizing us from the words as it does that. So you can hear in the poem that the poem's always rushing forward with this kind of Ginsbergian elastic breath, but punctuated by anaphora to stop us drowning in the language. Now, how does that relate to the form's content? How do we use that formal idea to kind of read what the poem's about? Well, first of all, the most typical examples of anaphora exist in the Bible. So it tells us automatically that the poem has this religious aspect, and I talked a bit about that last week when I related the word beat to beatitude. But that sense of lots of, you know those kind of lists of names in the Bible. Solomon became the father of Rehoboam, Rehoboam the father of Abjubar, Abjubar the father of Asaph. That in itself, became the father of, is itself anaphoric, and the Bible uses that all the time. Now, Ginsberg doesn't just take ideas from the Bible. I don't want you to think that he's just using the Bible as a nice kind of little reference book of metaphors and ideas. He's specifically interested in the experiential aspect of the Bible, i.e., what do you feel when you read the Bible? And for Shklovsky, that would tell us that the Bible is itself an art form. It's always poetical. For Ginsberg, the content of the Bible is both apocalyptic and creative at once. It's dominated by Genesis at the beginning and Revelation at the end. The creation at the beginning, the apocalypse at the end. So you've got that kind of, again, two different, very different ideas pushing the book on. Now, Ginsberg creates his own Genesis by insisting that the best minds of his generation are poets, artists, political radicals, jazz musicians, drug addicts, and psychiatric patients in the poem, all groups that see the world from an angle and are actually thought by the majority of at the time, the ideological mass, to be the worst minds, you know, political radicals, psychiatric patients, etc. It's unusual to say they're the best minds. So he's using that Genesis-like creation there, but he also draws very heavily on the apocalyptic imagery of the book of Revelation, the last book in the New Testament. So the book of Revelation, not the book of Revelations, in which the Apostle John recounts this nightmarish vision wherein a door opens in the sky to reveal a series of events that foretell the end of the world, in which Satan's rule through man is destroyed by the Messiah. I really encourage you to read the book of Revelation, particularly those of you who go on to do Romantic and Victorian poetry or 17th century literature and culture next year. The Bible is so inherent to those periods. You can't really hear all the references unless you've got a kind of sense of what those two books are about. And particularly Revelation is so full of these very poignant metaphors and descriptions that literary writers use constantly over and over again. Because the language is so vibrant and so vivid, here's John describing Satan, a beast coming out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads with 10 crowns on his horns, resembling a leopard, but he had feet like a bear and a mouth like that of a lion. That elastic breath, that kind of Ginsbergian sense that you get in Revelation is really resonant in those kind of sentences of the, trying to create these weird kind of monsters to get to the idea of what Satan is. Ginsberg's satanic creature, Ginsberg's revelationary creature is Moloch, which he uses in part two of Howl. Now, Moloch is a biblical creature. Moloch appears all over the Bible, in Leviticus, in Kings, in Jeremiah, in several other places all over the Bible. In Leviticus, Kings, and Jeremiah, he's particularly clear as this sort of fire god to whom children are sacrificed. So he's like, he's sometimes almost like a kind of bad Old Testament god, as opposed to a redeeming, benevolent New Testament god. Ginsberg takes that figure of Moloch from the Old Testament and suggests that it represents everything that is problematic in his own society. Moloch represents all the laws against homosexuality. It represents Joseph McCarthy, who I talked about last week, this communist hunting Republican. But it also represents industrial civilization, a politics that Ginsberg suggests forces humans to become robots in the service of capitalism. And his descriptions of Moloch are particularly inspired by a film that was produced in 1925 called Metropolis, directed by Fritz Lang, which is a silent science fiction film set in a futuristic urban dystopia. And I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to show you a clip from that now. So, if I do that. Oh, the PC. It's a very weird film, Metropolis, if anyone's seen it, set in the year 2026, which I guess in 1925 was seen as, you know, this incredible futuristic period, which it probably isn't really now. You can see all the people that have been on YouTube in this lecture hall. This could go really wrong, and we could end up with something really. We could end up with a bit of porn. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? That's wrong. I tried to make this connect from the PowerPoint, but without. Okay, here it is. Now, I'll just tell you that Metropolis is about, as I say, it's set in the year 2026. It's set in this corporate city called Metropolis, you know, London, New York, etc., where society is divided into two groups. The workers, who are these guys hanging out on the whatever they're doing there. I don't know what they're doing. And then the thinkers, who live in luxury upstairs. And that chap at the beginning, who you saw with a lot of eyeliner on, is a thinker, because he looks as though he's not working down there. And the film is really about what happens when the thinkers discover that there's all these workers underground holding up their existence. And this is where the thinkers discover what the workers are doing, which is feeding this monster called Moloch. But it's a kind of robot-like monster called Moloch. And I think we'll see him appear in a minute. It's getting exciting. It's not actually very exciting. There's the thinker, nice tie. Oh dear. There he is, there's Moloch. Well, there you go, you get the idea. You know, you feed the capitalist monster with fuel, but what the thinkers don't realise that it's like real human bodies that are feeding the monster, that are allowing the thinkers to live in luxury. And the workers don't know what they're doing either. The workers don't know that they're creating a monster that's simply designed to kind of eat up humans. So it's a very sort of striking example of how ideology evades everyone, even though they're still part of it. And you can really hear where Ginsberg's referring to those that film and these kind of biblical images of Moloch. When he writes, "Moloch, Moloch, robot apartments, invisible suburbs, skeleton treasuries, blind capitals, demonic industries, spectral nations, invincible mad houses, granite cocks, monstrous bombs. They broke their backs, lifting Moloch to heaven. Pavements, trees, radios, tons, lifting the city to heaven, which exists and is everywhere about us. Visions, omens, hallucinations, miracles, ecstasies." Now, we don't know whether visions, omens, hallucinations, miracles, ecstasies are an antidote to Moloch or not, but there's a sense in which they are. They're kind of driving us into this third part of the poem about rock